And welcome to Gillespie here on this Tuesday night in internet radio. I want to welcome you all. It is going to be a great show. It is going to be a fantastic show. We're going to be covering a bevy of subjects. Our guest tonight is Dr. Peter Berkowitz, author of Constitutional Conservatism. No, it's not what you think, people. It's not what you think. Tune in, listen to Dr. Peter Berkowitz. This is a fantastic interview. And it is led by the one, the only, the voice from St. Louis. You know her, you love her. She is the Smoozy Q.
Oh, Smoozy Q. Oh, Smoozy Q. Oh, Smoozy Q. Baby, I love you. Smoozy Q.
Smoozy.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm great.
I'll tell you, after that interview you just conducted, you are doing great.
Oh, well, thank you.
It was, and we should mention that our little old Smoozy Q, she's spreading her wings, people. I'm still jobless, but it's as if she's expecting me to be gone eventually so that she can take over the show for herself, which I guarantee you more people would probably tune into if she was leading it.
Oh, no.
Regardless, the Smoozy Q does lead the interview with Dr. Peter Berkowitz, author of Constitutional Conservatism, because, well, you read the book.
I did. Well, I mean, when I read the review of it, we talked about it on the show last week or the week before. I mean, I really was intrigued, and I have an enthusiasm and a passion for the principles that I saw outlined in the article, and so I grabbed the book, and it was a quick read. It's like 120 pages or something. It's not long at all. But it's a great overview of some very basic conservative principles and some great ideas and suggestions about, you know, for the conservative movement. So I thought it was a great read, and I was glad that he came on to be a guest, and I was happy to conduct the interview.
We should point out that for the second show in a row, our weak needs sellout establishment pansy pants is not here.
Of course not.
He is out and about gallivanting again, claiming to be at some meeting. Whatever, Mark. We know. You're just boozing it up, probably at Scotty's.
Mm-hmm.
Weak needs sellout pansy pants. Establishment rhino. Anyway, so there's Mark.
Meanwhile, Walker. You and I are here.
We are here.
Yeoman's work, right?
Yeah, that's right, because we owe it to the people.
We do.
Because we don't know if John Brodigan is still doing the right hook, so we're going to take over the phrase. We are absolutely taking over the phrase. We owe it to the people. But anyway, so yeah, we got a lot to talk about. I don't even know if we'll get to it all. I mean, sequestration is in the headlines. Of course, the ongoing GOP civil war is always a topic of discussion. Patrick Ruffini is now recruiting people like Katie Harbath and several others to basically take over, not the party, but just make us a stronger party. Technologically, messaging-wise, that's happening. And the Club for Growth decided to already get into the primaries. People, 2013 is supposed to be an off year unless you live in New Jersey or Virginia, because they got governor's races there. But still, 2013 is supposed to be an off year, damn it. Club for Growth, shut your yap, and you can do your primaries some other time. But stay the F out of Indiana. I'm just saying that now. We'll get to that
you
maybe eventually.
That.
That's right. Stay the F out of Indiana.
Right there.
Hoosiers are nice if we like you.
Until you mess with them.
Yeah, that's right. We liked your support of Murdoch, but if you get him involved in this one, not so much.
Yep.
Just saying, not so much. Anyway, the one thing that we do want to talk about, because it is a perfect segue into Susie's interview. It's our interview, but
it is.
Susie
you're,
leads.
You're a big part of it, too.
Susie, I just take over the end. Because, you know, I'm a vainglorious bastard. I want to talk about what you started last Friday on qwithaview.wordpress.com, which everybody should check out because we promote it at the end of every show.
Sure.
But you wrote an article, and I'm pulling it up here on my iPad, called Eye to Eye, letter I, not E-Y-E. But eye to eye, the idea takes shape. Now, what are you talking about here? Because it's a long post, and frankly, I haven't got time to read it.
No. I'll try and nutshell it for you, Josh. it's an idea that started percolating, you know, several months ago, as you know, and we've talked about it before on the show,
yes.
I am a former liberal. Now I'm a conservative. With everything that's happened in recent months, especially in regards to the election and the sort of growing pains the conservative movement seems to be feeling, it kept occurring to me, and many people have pointed out, there's so much at issue here with messaging. And, you know, there's this disconnect between these core conservative principles that seem so readily apparently appealing and yet aren't quite connecting with much of the populace. And it occurred to me that maybe because I have this sort of insight, which is certainly not unique. There are plenty of people who are former liberals, now conservatives. But because of that, because I have this little meager platform, mm-hmm. Maybe I could engage in this sort of thought experiment that would be a way to expand the message and reach more people in an appealing way. Mm-hmm. I remember my conversion and how it took shape and how much of that was prompted by people who patiently took the time to discuss concepts and issues with me as opposed to just getting in my face and doing battle with me. And I thought, well, you know what? I have this blog, and maybe there's a way for me to take, you know, important political issues, things that tend to be debated in the political sphere, and present an argument from the liberal perspective, because I do still remember the thought processes and how I used to think about things.
Wait. Liberals have thought processes?
Yes, I mean, they do.
They actually have a way to come to the conclusions that they actually hold?
They do.
Okay, I know that's mean, but I know that some of us actually think.
So to present the liberal side of things and then respond to it with the conservative side of things in a sort of, you know, an attempt to be even-handed, recognizing that because I am where I am now, mm-hmm. It's going to be weighted on the conservative side. And the whole idea is to make the conservative message seem more persuasive. But the reason I want it to be more persuasive is because I think it's right, not because I just want to be right. You know, I mm-hmm. want to be right. And so I kind of came up with this concept, and as I've been trying to put it together for several months, I've been alluding to it and never getting around to it. And then it occurred to me that, you know, a lot of what has inspired my activism and my wanting to have a voice and do something was Andrew Breitbart.
Mm-hmm.
And with the anniversary of his death looming, it occurred to me that it might be nice to try and tie it in to kind of honor his memory. And so that's what I did. I put together the blog to kind of outline what I'm going to attempt to do. Ideally, what's going to happen is once a week, every Friday, there'll be a new blog out from me, and it'll be a hot political topic discussed from the liberal me and the conservative me, and then I'll kind of leave it open to other people to comment if they want and see where it goes.
The liberal smoozy. I don't know how I could mentally take that. I mean,
I mean, 75% of my life was spent liberal.
Wow. Well, you know, here's the thing. You bring up Andrew. Andrew started out as a liberal.
Yes. It's one of the reasons I identified with him so closely was because, you know, he kind of had a similar conversion, if you will.
And you know, the thing is that, and his conversion, I mean, oh gosh, I don't know. I don't think we can find anybody who hasn't read his book. But you know, his conversion was just so interesting because he grew up, you know, basically in liberal Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, that's what you are, you know. And so many, but that's the way people. That's how they, for the most part, that's how they gain their any sort of political affiliation. That's what you are. I mean, because that's what your surroundings are. That's what you are.
Right.
And, you know, I can't imagine myself being a liberal. I mean, I have a feeling that I would have been shunned and kicked out of the family.
Well, see, now I face that now, although they're very kind. They don't try and shun me
well,
and kick me
good.
Out. They just look at me like I was abducted by aliens and wonder what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll definitely be interesting to kind of take a look at your perspective on different issues. Do you have an idea of some of the topics that you'll be addressing, or are you just going to kind of take it post by post?
I'm going to take it post by post, but one of the ideas I had to kind of guide my topics was to take those political spectrum quizzes that you see, especially in election
yeah.
year.
Oh, yeah.
And take the issues, or, you know, and not every single one, but take the issues that are thrown out there in those and kind of go through them one by one. Since that seems to be what people use, or a lot of people use, to sort of identify their label and determine where they stand on things. Because, I mean, you can just say a word, you can throw a word like abortion out there, and immediately it's a hot button and people have their stances and their backs are up. But when you mm-hmm. actually look at it and talk about the ideas, mm-hmm. You know, that inform people's views on it and look at it from that perspective, it you know, I think there's room there for people to maybe start opening up their eyes and realizing that, hey, there is something to this other view maybe that I was shutting out before because of the label. Well, so I don't know. I may have bitten off more than I can chew. I may be being overly optimistic about this, but I'm going to give it a shot.
I think you should actually be encouraged, especially after, you know, and again, people will be hearing this coming up next in our interview with Dr. Peter Berkowitz. But I mean, the thing is that we have to look at, especially within our own party, alternate views. I mean, right. you know, the Tea Party has to be open to, you know, some libertarianism or some, and we're talking about the socially moderate libertarians kind of stuff, or you know, moderates. It's we just all kind of have to be happy with some of our views, and I think that, and Dr. Berkowitz used this line, and it really kind of stuck out to me, that we shouldn't, you know, just sacrifice the good for the perfect.
Right.
And you know what? People, I know this sounds crazy, but sometimes liberals do have a nugget of good in some of those ideas. Nuggets. Nuggets. They are there. And so we shouldn't be going bashing them just because most of their idea is bad. We can say, hey, you know what? That right there, not bad. Let's work with that.
Right. Well, and ultimately, if you're hoping to persuade people who, you know, to your view of things, mm-hmm. you've got to be able to connect with them first.
Yeah.
You know, if all they do is shut you down, you're lost.
Exactly. And that was the beauty behind Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
People could connect with him.
Right. I mean, there are very few people that actually met and spent any time with him that can say they didn't just adore the man. I mean, mm-hmm. he was just one of those charismatic, very lovable people. And actually, in the blog that I wrote the day he died, I referred back to a moment at CPAC last year mm-hmm. when he came in to give a presentation on the upcoming Occupy Unmasked movie. And in the middle of the presentation, he got a call and jumped up and is talking on the phone and talking to the group and all of a sudden looks at everybody and says, oh, I got to go. It's Hannity. I'm supposed to be on Hannity, and like bounds out of the room. And I pointed out that, you know, I often describe people as their Winnie the Pooh archetypes. Mm-hmm. And if ever there was a Tigger, Andrew Breitbart was a Tigger.
I love it. Yes.
So I was happy to try and kind of revisit those memories and use his memory and his work as an inspiration for my little contribution. We'll see.
And I remember that CPAC so well, just because I remember him coming into the bloggers lounge wearing his Guy Fawkes mask.
Yes, yes.
And I mean, he didn't take it off. He was just kind of in and out, like he ran in and out as he was on his way to the stage. And I was mm-hmm. I remember thinking, it's like, I think that was Breitbart. And you know his portion comes up, and there he is, still in his cape. He's taking the mask off, and I was like, "Oh, it was Andrew."
Uh huh. Yep.
And I was like, "That's kind of awesome." Memories.
Yes. Yeah.
Memories. But anyway, we are going to use Susie's eye to eye concept. Here is our transition into our interview that is coming up next.
Yes.
With Dr. Peter Berkowitz. So, guys, stick around. This is a fantastic interview, and you're gonna learn stuff.
Yes, you will.
Prepare to have your mind expanded. All right, and after listening to it, you know, participating in it, at first I thought he was getting a little too constitution on us, but no, it all becomes so crystal clear the more you hear this man speak. So stick around. Dr. Peter Berkowitz will be our guest coming up next, author of, I will have to edit this part out.
Constitutional Conservatism.
Author of Constitutional Conservatism. So, and of course, again, the lead with the smoozy cue on this one. Yeah, hey. We're getting her more involved in the show because what? She's part of the show. We got to. But I just can't keep her back. I'm not going to keep the smoozy cue back. Yay. All right, people.
Nobody puts smoozy in the corner.
No one puts smoozy in the corner. Love it. Anyway, you're listening to Gillespie here on FTRRadio.com. We will be right back after this.
This is Andrew Breitbart, and you're listening to FTR Radio.
And welcome back to Gillespie. This is your co-host, Susie Moore, along with Josh Gillespie. And tonight we are very honored to have a special guest with us, Dr. Peter Berkowitz, who has a PhD in political science from Yale and a JD as well, and also is currently the Tad and Diane Taub Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution in Stanford University, and has recently authored a book called Constitutional Conservatism, which caught our eye a week or two back. And he was gracious enough to agree to come on with us tonight. Dr. Berkowitz, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be talking with you.
Your recent book, Constitutional Conservatism, as I mentioned, caught our eye back. We saw a review of it in Real Clear Politics, I think, by Heather Wilhelm.
Yes.
What prompted you to write the book? What inspired it?
Well, it goes back, really, I suppose, about 4.5, 5 years ago. Was after Candidate Obama's election, Senator Obama's election, President of the United States, and I found that in conversations with my libertarian friends, they were very angry with social conservatives, and really they were fed up with what they regarded as excessive moralism. They wanted to go their own way politically. But a funny thing, in my conversations with my social conservative friends, I found that they were fed up with libertarians. Those Philistines who cared nothing about the moral foundations of a free society, and the social conservatives want to go their own way. And though I'm not a scholar of electoral politics in the United States, it was evident even to my eye that neither the social conservatives nor the libertarians could, as conservatives, win election, could cobble together an electoral majority. So what I wanted to know was whether there was a common foundation, a principled foundation, on which social conservatives and libertarians could come together. Not just a kind of modus vivendi, an agreement to live with each other, although that could be justified, but whether they could rally around common principles that were philosophically coherent and created also a politically potent alliance.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. I know that throughout the book you refer to political moderation, and you are quick to point out that it's often the idea of moderation or moderate is stigmatized in the name of purity. But you do a very thorough job of explaining what you mean by it. Could you explain that to our audience a little bit?
Sure, I'll try. And as you already suggested, it's really very important, though, to begin with how moderation is commonly understood. When you say the word moderation, you know, most people think of splitting the difference or path to least resistance or compromise for the sake of compromise. And that's not how I understand the term, and I think that's a bad understanding of moderation. I think that's a kind of betrayal. I would say that political moderation, well understood, or maybe the highest form of political moderation, involves the exercise of the virtue, involved in recognizing and balancing worthy and competing principles. That's political moderation, recognizing that in a free society, there are a variety of principles that we wish to give their due to, but that it's difficult because sometimes they pull in opposite directions. And I think that conservatives should feel this feel this need to balance most acutely because conservatives traditionally and properly are concerned about the relationship between liberty and tradition. Not just concerned about the relationship, but want to defend liberty and understand that the defense of liberty depends upon tradition.
Dr. Berkowitz, you say that these conversations and the ideas for this book started, 4 years ago after candidate Obama was elected. Could you basically see what the media is calling a GOP civil war at this current point? Could you see that coming on the horizon between all these differing factions?
Well, you mean the media calling it today or calling it back then?
Calling it back then, I mean,
yes.
Could you basically see this rift? I guess you could say it's been there kind of in the background, but, for seemingly we've kind of come together for the good of the party, but in recent years we've just kind of broken down into our own little subgroups.
That's right. And there was, in this particular case, the rift was not a figment of the media's imagination. It was a real rift in late 2008 and early in 2009. There was a myth that the media did try to promulgate, and the myth that the media tried to promulgate was in the winter of 2009, 4 years ago, is that conservatism is dead. Mm-hmm. Very prominent, progressive, left liberal journalists such as George Packer at The New Yorker, E.J. Dionne at The Washington Post, Sam Tannenhaus in The New York Times, who, by the way, is back at it last month in The New
Republic, course.
proclaiming that back then in 2009, that conservatism is dead, the death of conservatism. And there was this rift, and many conservatives were worried themselves. But here we must give credit where credit is due. One man who deserves a lot of credit for reviving conservatism in the spring of 2009 is President Barack Obama.
I would completely agree.
It was thanks to, because we had the serious rift, but thanks to the president's progressive overreach, and I would say the neglect of working to create more jobs and promote growth in the economy, focusing on health care, he galvanized. Conservatives, in particular the Tea Party movement. Now, elements of the Tea Party movement had already been around in the last part of the Bush administration. They were concerned about President Bush's extravagant spending. But that was dwarfed by President Obama's extravagant spending. And the felt urgency of limiting or re-limiting government and bringing spending under control and focusing on jobs is what inspired this tremendous grassroots movement in the country that came to be called the Tea Party movement. May I add one more thing about that?
Sure.
The composition of the Tea Party is very interesting. On the one hand, it's really narrowly focused on relimiting government and containing spending. But membership contains a high proportion of social conservatives. What that suggested to me is another factor propelling me to write the book was that in the face of this crisis, social conservatives were willing to not abandon their social conservative concerns, but to make a priority of the economic questions being, of course, the natural province also of the libertarian conservatives. Mm-hmm. So the crisis forced back together what had been rent asunder in the previous years.
You, how would you say the views that you or the conclusions that you reach in the book either are similar to or different to those of the Tea Party?
Well, the Tea Party deserves a lot of credit for having declared already in 2009 that that in order to reclaim our way, which we've lost, we need to return to the Constitution. And I make an argument in my little book that we do indeed need to return to the Constitution, that the Constitution embodies a wisdom about the organization of politics that in many respects we've lost sight of, and that we would greatly benefit from reclaiming. And I don't want to insist on a sharp difference, but I do think that sometimes you see among people affiliated with the Tea Party movement, the sense that what we find in the Constitution is a set of absolutely clear principles which we can apply unproblematically to the challenges of today. What I think we find in the Constitution is indeed a set of principles, about liberty. We do find a limited government of defined and enumerated powers. That's extremely important. But I worry that, sometimes that what is neglected is another feature that we find in the Constitution. Back to the term with which we began, I think the Constitution has inscribed in it political moderation. That's its big lesson. That's why we have separation of powers. That's why we have checks and balances. That's why we have representation. That's why we have a bicameral legislature, a unitary executive, and an independent judiciary. These different branches of government are combined and blended in such a way as to produce outcomes that do as much justice as possible to the various principles under which we live.
And I like the way that you describe that. One of the chapters in the book you also devote to the British statesman Edmund Burke, and you explain how he's really still relevant even to today's American conservatives. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. You know, many people regard him as the father of modern conservatism, and I'm one of those people. Why do I say modern conservatism? Because to be a conservative raises a question. What is it that you wish to conserve? What Edmund Burke wished to conserve, what he thought was the highest task in politics, was conserving our freedom, conserving a liberty. What makes him also conservative is his acute appreciation of how much conserving liberty depended upon also respecting tradition, order, and virtue. So that's very important for conservatives to appreciate, but so is this. Edmund Burke is the conservative author, or is the author of a very conservative work called Reflections on the Revolution of France, which sharply attacks the French revolutionaries. He wrote this relatively late in his career. Before that, Burke was most famous for stands he took in regard to the American colonies, in regard to Irish Catholics, in regard to the indigenous population of Asian India. In all of those cases, Burke argued for reform, for accommodation, for balance, for calibration. He wanted the Americans to be included in deliberations about taxations on the colonies. He wanted greater toleration for Irish Catholics. He wanted them to enjoy their natural rights to worship as they saw fit. And he wanted the indigenous population of India, he wanted their rights to be respected. He thought they were being trampled upon by the British East India Company. So in some respects, Burke is a great reformer. In another respect, he's the great critic of let's call it progressive transformation. You could ask which is the true Burke, and the answer is both Burkes are the true Burke. As Burke wisely said, and we should remember, the ideal of the statesman is disposition to preserve and the disposition to improve. Conservatives are conservation, or conserving involves both conserving and improving. I think that American conservatives in, let's say, the last 10 years or so, have a bit forgotten that part of the conservative imperative is also to reform. Of course, in light of conservative principles, prudently, incrementally, as much as circumstances allow, but still, conserving involves improving.
Sure. And you know, you referred to the to conservatives over the past 10 years, and we kind of alluded to it earlier, this sort of rift that's become apparent on the right side of the political spectrum, and it's readily apparent since the November 2012 election. What sorts of challenges do you see conservatives facing now, and maybe possible ways to resolve those?
Well, yes, for me, Also, when people hear the term political moderation, they think it's an injunction that conservatives should learn to live with progressives, get along with progressives. By the way, I think that would be a good thing. But what I've been primarily interested in, conservatives figuring out how to get along with each other. So that's the first priority, I think, that limited government conservatives or libertarians and social conservatives, those concerned especially with preserving traditional morality, that they rediscover the common basis. Common basis should be, I think, focus on the principles of liberty inscribed in the Constitution. As far as public policy goes, I think that conservatives have an excellent opportunity in the coming months and years to deal with the need for entitlement reform, the need for immigration reform, the need for tax reform, and so on. I think conservatives have a message of individual liberty. And as far as entitlements go, right now we are on a trajectory that is going to render insolvent our big entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That certainly is not not going to benefit the poor, the disadvantaged, those who can't care for themselves. Conservatives need to take this opportunity not merely to talk about not raising taxes, as important as tax reform is, but what can be done consistent with conservative principles. By that I mean, talk more about this, but I mean limited government, I mean individual liberty, I mean focus as much as possible on civil society and the private sector to preserve them and unleash them. Conservatives need to devise reforms of these entitled programs. It's important to contain spending. It's important not to raise taxes, but it's also important to put forward constructive proposals. Representative Paul Ryan has done that with Roadmap 2.0. There's much to quarrel with in there, but that's a good thing. The quarrel should now be about specific reforms. That's what conservatives need to focus on now, specific reforms of these programs that are desperately in need of reform.
Dr. Berkowitz, I kind of have a two-part question here. First of all, in regards to working towards reforms, as you mentioned, Congressman Ryan has put together his Roadmap 2.0, but at the same time, the Republicans, especially in the House, seem to be struggling with this concept of reforms. You know, they call for these reforms. They say we need reforms, but outside of Congressman Ryan and maybe a few others, it seems as if it's mostly all talk and less action coming from the House.
Well, seems to me that's partly right, but we have to keep in mind that the Republican Party cannot govern simply by a majority in the House of Representatives, right?
True. Absolutely. You know,
right. So, so this is a problem with my answer. What needs to be added is that the Republicans, conservatives, also have to go out into the country and make their argument to the people. Now,
right.
Conservatives, there are 30 Republican governors in the country now. The Republicans have unified control of governorships and houses. Have significantly more than Democrats do. There
That's
is
true.
Support for conservative governance, especially at the local level. But conservatives not only have to draft proposals of reform, conservatives have to rediscover a rhetoric that will persuade Americans, and not just the same old Americans. You know, everybody knows, and it's true, that Republicans suffered, or Mitt Romney suffered, a drubbing among blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and single women between the ages of 20 and 35.
Right.
That needs to be corrected. I believe that there is a conservative message that is attractive and can be made attractive to not to every one of these groups. You can't win everybody in a free country, but to significantly more individuals in those four groups, black, Hispanics, Asians, and single women ages 20 to 35, than Mitt Romney managed to do.
So would you then kind of counter to some of the reforms that are being pushed in the Senate. When you talk about like Edmund Burke style reforms, could they apply that to in their attempt to, because we're seeing this obviously within the GOP, especially in the Senate with Senator Rubio, the mm-hmm. appeal to the Hispanic voters with immigration reform?
Well, look, I think yes, but more than that, I think that Senator Rubio is very much on the right track, but and I think the his immigration proposal, I hope it's of appeal to more Hispanics, but I hope it's appeal to a wide range of Americans. I mean, essentially, he has tried to put forward a balanced proposal which recognizes, on the one hand, the importance of the United States in living in accordance with the law. We have to put an end to illegal immigration, and we shouldn't approve actions that were done illegally. On the other hand, and this is, in my view, a proper kind of reasoning. On the other hand, there are between 11 and 14 million illegal immigrants in this country, undocumented workers, and they're partly here because we encourage them to come, or we turned a blind eye. Mm-hmm. In any case, America, it is a fact, America does not have the will and is not going to deport these 11 to 14 million. They're not going to deport themselves. We need to find a way that also reflects the fact that we don't want to improve of illegal conduct, to, as Rubio says, provide a path to citizenship. And, you know, he's made it arduous, he's made it long, made sure that those who come here, who have come to our shores legally, are not penalized as a result of that. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to weigh and consider a variety of factors. In my judgment, he's taking circumstances as they are, not as they wish to be. He's not making the perfect the enemy of the good, and so on. And I think it's this sort of thing that conservatives are going to have to do. More like Rubio, more like Ryan, go out into the country with concrete proposals and explain how those proposals both respect facts and try to improve situation in America in light of conservative principles.
I think that's a fabulous idea, especially engaging the governors, since we do own we own a plurality of the governorships in the country. Kind of the second part of my question, even though I already asked the second question, but I it kind of coming full circle to the conversation, or kind of going back to what we were originally talking about in terms of the continuity of the party. According to the article from Real Clear Politics, you know, they break down how you were talking about the libertarians, the Tea Party activists, the social conservatives, the moderates. But you say, but without each other, these groups can do nothing on the electoral stage. And obviously we saw that. That was plainly evident in 2012. What do these groups need to do to get past their, you know, some of their disparate beliefs, mm-hmm. to find a sense of unity so that we can get behind as a party behind a presidential candidate that actually has a chance at winning?
Well, so the first thing is to recognize that if you're devoted to purity, politics is probably not your sphere. Not the sphere. The world.
Thank you, Dr. Berkowitz.
It's not built that way. But, and this is important, what I'm not advocating is the abandonment of principle. Not at all. In fact, mm-hmm. I think what I'm advocating is taking principle even more seriously. What I mean is, you know, you'll find some conservatives, they rally around a single principle, single idea, limited government. At all costs, government must be shrunk. Don't bother me about any other consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Other conservatives are focused exclusively on preserving traditional morality or some particular aspect of traditional morality. But if other issues, don't bother me. So what I would like to say to conservatives who are especially interested in limited government, that fine as that principle is, we also must pay attention to the moral foundations of a free society. We need people to sustain these free institutions. People who can sustain them are people who can exercise basic virtues like self-discipline and self-control, like courage, like industry, like rationality, and so on. And that these virtues, they don't come from nowhere. They don't grow on trees. people with such virtues, the virtues that help you maintain a free society, those virtues are cultivated. They're cultivated by families. They're cultivated by communities. They're cultivated in schools. They're cultivated by religion. Not saying it's the role of government, but in fact, I'm saying it's mostly not. But
right.
The limited government conservatives need to pay attention to civil society and make sure at least that we don't have laws, we don't have forms of conduct. We should be concerned about a culture that undermines civil society. Similarly, if your focus is on social conservative issues, you should recognize that hardly anybody has more to lose from a big government that's legislating morals than you.
Mm-hmm.
What's in the special interest of social conservatives, it seems to me, is keeping government limited. A lot more harm will come from government getting involved in your communities and families and prescribing things than from government giving you, your religious community, your family room to operate. So this is what needs to be, this is the message that needs to be sent, the common basis for limited government conservatives and social conservatives come together. And by the way, I have to say that in the younger generation of Republican leaders, the 40-somethings, Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio, I see individuals in whom the social conservative sensibility and the limited government sensibility coexist fairly easily.
Yes.
That's a good thing, I think. Also, you know, you don't hear stridency in Ryan, you don't hear stridency in Rubio, you don't hear stridency in relatively young governor of Louisiana, mm-hmm. Bobby Jindal. You don't hear it very much in the relatively young governor, Indian, and female, Nikki Haley of South Carolina.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
These are positive signs. They're governors. Two of them are governors and reformers, Jindal and Nikki Haley.
Right, right.
That's a really good point.
I think I'd add, too, Dr. Berkowitz, that another way that the conservatives might find some common ground and learn to work to common purpose is to pick up your book, Constitutional Conservatism, which is very easy to find on Amazon and is a great read. It's a quick read. It's very easy to digest, and I think it's a worthwhile read.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Sure. And where else can they find your work?
Well, I actually have a web page, easy to remember, www.peterberkowitz.com, and it's got a listing of all of my articles on it, links to all the articles, many by now, a list of links to my various other books, both authored by me and edited by me.
Great, great. Well, we certainly do thank you for coming on
yes.
and speaking with us tonight. It's been
thank
great
you.
Talking to you and really appreciate what you have to say.
Well, thank you very much. It's been good talking to you.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Peter Berkowitz. Again, be sure to check out his book, Constitutional Conservatism. You can pick it up on Amazon or in the bookstores. And we appreciate him being here.
Thank you, Dr. Berkowitz.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for your questions. And thanks for giving me some opportunity to roam.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Have a good night.
You as
Thank
well.
You
as well. You're listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be right back after this.
I know, don't quite feel right. Where we're going, outcome uncertain, yes.
In a world beyond human understanding, one radio station holds the key, FTRradio.com.
And welcome back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. I hope you all stuck around through Dr. Berkowitz's fascinating interview. And I want to kind of go off a little bit on what he was talking about, and especially in terms of messaging and communication. And he talked a little bit about reaching out to our nation's governors, especially if Republicans want to spread the message and the reform message. I think it's a fantastic idea to incorporate our governors. I know governors like to kind of be a little bit separate. Obviously, Obamacare is kind of bringing them in. John Kasich, Rick Scott, yeah, we're looking at you. We got some terse words. We're looking right at you. All right. Anyway, But along those lines of communication, and this has been an ongoing subject here on this show since the election, and maybe some of you have heard, I'm sure many of you have heard if you've been on Facebook or Twitter at all, that Patrick Ruffini, he of Engage fame, the former former digital director for the RNC, is wanting to basically get the Netroots active and responsible on the GOP side. And Time wrote this big old article in their section called Swampland, and it's called Republican Consultants Plot New Tech-Savvy Infrastructure. And he's bringing in the likes of Katie Harbath, who handles, she's been a guest on this show. She's handles Republican campaign outreach for Facebook, as Kristen Soltis Anderson, a pollster at the Winston Group, and Rihan, I know I'm going to get that wrong, and I'm sorry, Salam, a political columnist for the National Review. Anyway, what they did is basically what Democrats did after Bush won in 2004. They looked at what we did and copied it and took it to another level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what was funny is that I did a hit for this on WIBC, which is the local talk radio station here in Indianapolis. And they had a guy on who was talking about it. And he basically, the first quote out of his mouth was too little too late. And while, you know, copying is basically, you know, the sincerest form of flattery, that kind of thing, Republicans probably aren't up to it, which I tend to disagree. When you look at the people who are involved in this and the people who are already excited about this, Sean Hackbarth was all over this, George Scoville. And basically what this is doing already, just in the few hours that this article has been out, is doing exactly what Dr. Berkowitz was talking about. And it's bringing in people who cover the differing areas of conservatism. It has your moderates, it has your conservatives, it has your Tea Partyists, it has your libertarians, and they're all getting together so that we can basically figure out our digital issues. And I think this is an absolutely fantastic idea. And they're not the only ones. The RNC is doing their thing. The Koch brothers are doing their thing. And I think that this is important that all these people are involved. I mean, I'm interested to see how Patrick does, just because the group that he's pulling together, and he's making it more open source than I'm guessing the Koch brothers and the RNC are doing. I mean, basically, Patrick is opening this up to anybody who wants to be involved. It's not like a paying gig. It's just like, hey, you want to be involved in this? Here's how, you know, check this stuff out. These are the things that we're trying to do. Get yourself plugged into some of these things. And they're basically coming up with conservative offshoots of liberal ideas, and not liberal ideas, but, you know, like liberal
methods, or
yes, liberal methods. And that includes coming up with a think tank, an R&D institute or lab, as they're liking to call it. But all of this is basically under the umbrella of Empower Action Group. And I think this is just a really good idea to create some of these outlets for conservatives to come in and get the training that they need. Because the first line was telling to me, the first paragraph, where he's like, and this is from the article, straight from the article, after last year's blowout election, the Republican digital strategist Patrick Ruffini went on a not-so-secret mission to find out how to fix what was wrong with his party. In less than 12 hours, the infiltration hashtag begins, he tweeted, the day before the start of Roots Camp, an annual conference for Democratic digital data and grassroots strategists that is held by the liberal nonprofit group called the New Organizing Institute. What he found at the event came as sort of a revelation, a vast liberal brain trust bursting with young talent who had advanced far beyond Republicans in the art and science of using data analytics and voter outreach. And people, this is what we used to excel at.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he's wanting to bring us back. And it reminded me so much of the book Crashing the Gates by Marcus Moulitsis of Daily Kos fame. And in 2006, probably January 2007, I read his book. Then I read Winning Right by Ed Gillespie. And so I read Crashing the Gate after the Democrats had taken over the House in 2006. And it was mind-blowing because you saw what he was talking about. And he was talking about, this is what Republicans did right. This is what we need to do. And he was talking about voter outreach, grassroots strategy, and data analytics, all this stuff. And it's progressed so far in the last 8 years that Democrats have kept up, and it's just surpassed Republicans. And it's time to play catch up, and someone like Patrick Ruffini is doing that. And him and Katie Harbath and a host of others. I think it's brilliant, and I support Patrick and his efforts. And it's good to know that there are these outlets for Republicans who do want to be involved in this way. And it is an umbrella kind of idea. You know, you don't have to be a moderate. You don't have to be a Tea Party. You don't have to be a conservative. You don't have to be a libertarian.
Right.
I mean,
it's not about philosophy. It's about, you know, actual practicality, I guess.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Practicality is something that we don't understand right now. But Patrick does.
Yay.
God bless him. Someone has to. Ah. Speaking of people who don't understand practicality.
Uh-oh.
You like that transition?
It was a good one.
Okay, suck it, Club for Growth. That's the first thing. Okay.
How do you really feel, Josh?
So last week, they came out with a website. I think it's called primarymycongressman.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I just... Okay, first of all, the last thing we need right now is division, all right? We have the sequester going on. We have Democrats controlling messaging and winning, for the most part, the messaging war, although the president seems to be losing it a bit on sequestration, which is awesome because, frankly, yeah. Oh, no, we can't cut $85 billion. Yeah, you can, you... I mean, and seriously, look at where this money is going.
Right.
In terms of the sequestration, some of this, and it is just absolutely mind-boggling... Where money is allocated, and
yeah.
that's what we have to do. Okay, so this $85 billion that's wrapped up in sequestration, some of it is actually useful money that we could use and need, and some of it isn't. And then you have money that isn't part of the sequestration, like, you know, experiments on robotic squirrels.
Right.
All right. That's not even touched, but you're threatening DOD.
Right.
Okay.
And sending $250 million to Egypt.
Yeah, seriously. Screw you. All right. And that's my bit on sequestration. We'll get to more of that because next week we're going to have Senator Dan Coats to talk about
that.
Yeah. But anyway, so Club for Growth, it was apparently, you know, they're like, you know what? We don't care what happened in 2012. We're getting the itch to primary congressman again. And so they put up this website, primarymycongressman.com. And basically you can go there and rat out your congressman to Club for Growth,
right.
And be like, I want you to primary my guy. And they already have a few that they've targeted. One of them is Indiana Congressman Larry Bouchon. Which is an absolute joke. Larry was first elected in 2010. He did have a Tea Party challenger in his in an open seat in the 8th District of Indiana. He beat the Tea Party challenger. It was a close race. He won with, I think, 36% of the vote. She challenged him again in 2012 and got her hiney handed to her. Okay? So this whole idea of he's not conservative enough, well, he certainly handled the GOP primary, and he handled his Democratic opponent. And the 8th District, mind you, people, in Indiana is a fickle district. I encourage you to Google the Bloody 8th in Indiana, and you will find a whacked-out-ass history of the 8th District, including in 1984, they elected a Republican, but you know what? The state legislature decided that something was goofy, and so they pulled the state legislature. The state legislature pulled the Republican out and replaced him with a Democrat.
Hmm.
I don't even know how that's even constitutionally possible, but they did it.
Who knows?
Anyway, so Larry Bouchon has only been in for one term. He got reelected. He has twice won. I shouldn't say twice won. He's won, well, I guess twice. Yeah, because it's only been 2 years. He's twice won the American Conservative Union Award, Defender of Liberty, the conservative thing. He scores in, he had an 84 and an 88 his first 2 years, which is good for Defender of Liberty status.
Right.
He got a perfect 100 from the Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He signed the American Taxpayer Reform Pledge from Grover Norquist. Seriously, how much more Republican can you get than that? He scores 100% from the National Right to Life. He has a 94% from the American Farm Bureau, 92% from the National Rifle Association, 83% from Gun Owners of America, 90% from Family Research Council, and 100% from the Catholic Advocate.
Right.
And this is all for Project Vote Smart. This isn't hard to find, people. But because he didn't vote the way that the Club for Growth wanted him to, because, oh yeah, I guess Larry Bouchon, he wasn't informed that he's supposed to represent Club for Growth's interests in Congress and not his districts. He scored 64% 1 year and 72% the next year, which apparently makes him prime rhino fodder.
Right.
And so we have Tea Party groups here in Indiana who are already jacked up about this one, who's affiliated with my favorite organization, Freedom Works. Anyway.
Well, you know, I think there's merit to the concept of primarying, but it seems to me that it needs to be targeted primarying and principled. Primarying, not just for the sake of saying, hey, you know, we've got a fight, we want to take it to somebody so we can keep fighting. I mean, I feel like some of this is motivated by just this kind of angst-driven desire to fight and win a fight.
Yes, it is. I absolutely 100% agree. And the sad thing is that rumor has it they're trying to recruit Richard Murdoch, who, again, we've had on the show, despite his terrible faux pas in this general election. We love him on this show, but I'm sorry, I cannot support him if he takes Club for Growth action and runs against Larry in that district, which would be interesting if he did, because in the general election, Richard Murdoch won the 8th district. Oddly, Mike Pence lost. Indeed. Well, we've really kind of come up to the end of the show, and I didn't even get to—I didn't have a Mark Warner-style rant against Club for Growth, and I totally have one, but I have it already online. So go to HoosierAccess.com and check out my article, creatively titled "Club for Growth Proves It Doesn't Get Indiana." Hey, by the way, just throwing this out there, Chris Chocola, former congressman, now chairs Club for Growth. Yeah, he's from Indiana. Go figure. Anyway, so, hey, Smoozy.
Yes.
Where can they find you on the internet?
They can find me on my blog at qwithaview.wordpress.com, and it actually has new content, so please go check it out. And they can find me on Twitter at SmoozyQ.
And make sure to check out her Eye to Eye, her series that she'll be posting every Friday. Yeah. On Q with a View. And you can find me at joshgillespie.com and also at Josh Gillespie on the Twitters. Joshgillespie.com, where you can find the complete archive of Gillespie. So, for the Smoozy Q, you've listened to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com, and I was your host, Josh Gillespie. Our thanks to, again, Dr. Peter Berkowitz for being our guest this week. Stay tuned for a repeat of tonight's Snark Factor coming up. And that's going to do it for us. So, see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Don't speak like you used to. And where do we go to now that I...
It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?